quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He's part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species, and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New research has shown the effects of human-caused global heating are blocking vital winter rains in Spain and Portugal, with severe implications for farming and tourism on the Iberian Peninsula. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment editor Damien Carrington. The piece is titled Spain and Portugal Suffering Driest Climate for 1,200 Years, Research Shows. Spain and Portugal are suffering their driest climate for at least 1,200 years, according to new research with severe implications for both food production and tourism in both countries. Most rain on the Iberian Peninsula falls in winter, as wet, low-pressure systems blow in from the Atlantic Ocean. But a high-pressure system off the coast, called the Azores High, can block the wet weather fronts. The Azores High is a semi-permanent area of high pressure that migrates east and west, depending on the season. During the Northern Hemisphere summer and autumn, the center of the Azores High is located in the western North Atlantic Ocean, near the island of Bermuda. In the winter and early spring, it is primarily centered near the Azores, in the eastern part of the North Atlantic Ocean. The researchers found that winters featuring extremely large Azores highs have increased dramatically from one winter in 10 before 1850 to one winter in 4 since 1980. These extremes also pushed the wet weather northwards, making downpours in northern United Kingdom and Scandinavia more likely. The scientists said the more frequent Azores high could only have been caused by climate crisis, caused by humanity's carbon emissions. The number of extremely large Azores High in the last 100 years is really unprecedented when you look at the previous 1,000 years, said Dr. Caroline Umerhofer at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in the United States and part of the new research team. That has big implications because an extremely large Azores High means relatively dry conditions for the Iberian Peninsula and for the Mediterranean region, she said. We could also conclusively link this increase to anthropogenic emissions. The Iberian Peninsula has been hit by increasing heat waves and droughts in recent years, and this year, the month of May was the hottest on record in Spain. Forest fires that killed dozens of people in the region in 2017 followed a heat wave made 10 times more likely by the climate crisis. While the Tagus River, the longest river in the region, is at risk of drying up completely, according to environmentalists. The new research published in the journal Nature Geoscience analyzed weather data stretching back to 1850 and computer models replicating the climate back to AD 850. It found that before 1850 and the start of significant human greenhouse gas emissions, extremely large exhaust highs occurred once every 10 years on average. From 1850 to 1980, the frequency was once every 7 years. But after 1980, this rose to every 4 years. Data showed that extremely large exhaust highs slash average monthly rainfall in winter by about a third. Further data from chemical analysis of stalagmites in caves in Portugal show that low rainfall correlates closely with large exhaust highs. The computer simulation of the climate of the past millennium covers a period up to 2005, but other studies covering later years are consistent with the new findings, and the exhaust high is expected to continue to expand, further increasing drought on the Iberian Peninsula, until global carbon emissions are cut to net zero. Our findings have big implications for the water resources that are available for agriculture and other water-intensive industries, or for tourism, said Caroline Umehofer. It doesn't bode well. Spain was the second most popular country for overseas tourists in 2019, hosting 84 million visitors. Spain also is the world's biggest producer of olives and a major source of grapes, oranges, tomatoes and other produce. But rainfall has been declining in Spain by 5 to 10 millimetres a year since 1950, with a further 10 to 20% drop in winter rains anticipated by the end of the century. Other research has projected a 30% decline in olive production in southern Spain by 2100 and a fall in grape-growing regions across the Iberian Peninsula of 25% to 99% by 2050, due to severe water shortages. Research in 2021 also linked the exhaust high to the summer monsoon in India.
Midstream.
Hear me out. Spread the map of the Arab world in front of you and observe the capitals of its so-called pivotal states, and tell me about the extent of the Zionist penetration in it and the unprecedented depth reached by the official relations between these countries and the Israeli occupation. Move from the map of the Arab world to the Islamic world and see where the relations and alliances have reached between countries that call themselves the centers of moderate Islam and the Zionist enemy. From the Atlantic Ocean in the west to the Persian Gulf in the east, then from the Mediterranean in the north to Turkey, then to Sudan in the south. Passing through Egypt, you will find Israel heavily present in a way that makes it actually at the helm of an Arab-Islamic Zionist axis hostile to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the Palestinian resistance. From Erdogan to bin Salman through Sisi, the soldiers of Sudan and the majority of the rulers of the Arab states in the Persian Gulf, you will find everyone involved in the project of building an alliance with the Zionists, for whom the King of Jordan chose the name Arab NATO under the pretext of countering the ambitions of the Iranian project in the region. Others have dubbed the alliance MESA, the Middle East Strategic Alliance. Every passing day reveals that the new Middle East strain with American engines and Israeli leadership continues invading the Arab maps. Only a few points remain that have not yet joined the track, bearing in mind that this sacred train is under American patronage and guard, requiring all those who join it to contribute to financing it, keeping maintenance, renovating it, and replacing its main station once in a while. These are no longer hypothetical scenarios, nor conspiracy theories, but rather a reality that has crystallized since the Negev summit headed by Israel, and before that, the expansion of the umbrella of the American Central Region to include the Zionist occupation forces with the Arab armies in one military axis, and much earlier with the summit of the Arab League, which was held in Tehran in Saudi Arabia, with its main theme being the removal of Israel from the list of enemies and inserting Iran instead. The project seems to be approaching completion with the expected visit of U.S. President Joe Biden to the region next month, so that all the capitals of the Arab moderates and the other Islamic non-Arab states will be involved in this axis led by Israel. This adherence to the Zionist project, which is based on devouring all of Palestine, has continued in full swing for years. It takes forms of explicit hostility to the principle of resistance to the occupation and submits the countries that conform to American dictates militarily and economically to the Israeli will. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Within hours of the Jordanian monarch's announcement of his support for the establishment of a Middle Eastern NATO or Arab NATO, dozens of questions surfaced. Who are the member states expected to join it? Will Israel be one of them? Who is the target enemy of this alliance? Recently, Washington announced the intention of U.S. President Joe Biden to visit West Asia, and according to the statement issued by the White House, the visit is part of an American pressure to build a broader security/economic alliance that includes Arab countries and Israel. A few days ago, the Wall Street Journal published an extensive news story related to the meeting of U.S. military officials with their counterparts in Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and several Persian Arab Gulf states. According to the source, the meeting was held in the Egyptian city of Sharm el-Sheikh, and it dealt with exploring ways of coordinating against, wait for it, Iran's growing missile capabilities and its drones program. Now, to discuss this issue with us from London is Ms. Isra Al-Fas, political commentator and journalist. Thank you very much for being with us. Isra, now, MESA, M-E-S-A, the Middle East Strategic Alliance, an Arab NATO, as some is calling it, now led by none other than the Zionist entity by direct order of the United States of America. The organization is supposed to provide a joint response to conflicts, to terrorism, and above all, what at the same time countering what they call Iran's influence in the region. Although this step might not be a surprise, to be honest with you, with many in our region, however, is it applicable in West Asia?
I don't think that the idea of an Arab NATO is actually applicable in the region. We are speaking here about countries which the Jordanian king described as the one formation countries. However, a lot of issues are happening behind closed doors between these countries. We still have obvious Saudi-Jordanian differences. The Jordanians are still holding Saudi Arabia responsible for the attempted coup that was being prepared to overthrow the king. there is an escalation of economic competition between the United Arab Emirates and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We see how both countries are going head-to-head competing to score foreign investments, each in their own economies. Those differences were even reflected in the battlefield inside Yemen, specifically in the southern Yemen. Look at the relations between Egypt and other Persian Gulf Arab states. Differences and contentions are being openly discussed and reported about in the Egyptian media, specifically in the pro-regime Egyptian newspapers, including reactions to these differences that are being put out in the open on social media. For example, Turki Al-Hamad, who is a Saudi journalist well known to be close to the Emirati regime, he tweeted recently that Egypt is a burden to its allies. This is an example of the one formation countries which King Abdullah was referring to. Similarly, look at the internal Israeli political situation. We see that it's very fragile security-wise as well, evidently by the series of defeats that Israel has experienced in all its wars throughout the past decade. Therefore, there are no grounds for such an alliance to be formed. It might be formed as part of a show, but previous experiences suggest that such an alliance will eventually fail, which makes it inapplicable in our region.
Well, Mrs. Sarah, do you think that the Islamic Republic and the Axis of Resistance will have some sort of response or reflection? How do you think that they will perceive this effort to create a Mesa in West Asia that is namely and audaciously put out against them?
When we speak of a Middle Eastern NATO, what are we actually talking about? Are we speaking about Khaliji armies, specifically a Saudi army, or an Emirati army? Bahrain obviously is out of the picture. When we speak about Khaliji armies, we remember their failures inside Yemen for 8 years now. Hence, why would the resistance axis in general and the Islamic Republic of Iran in specific have any concerns or fears from these so-called armies? If we want to pinpoint the Israeli role, Israel has a previous experience with the resistance forces in West Asia, and the result was one defeat for Israel after the other. So I believe that this so-called alliance is no reason for the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I believe that this so-called alliance is no reason for the Islamic Republic of Iran to be worried about its security. Iran has already been there when it was facing Saddam Hussein in the eight-year war with direct U.S. orders and funding from Arab states of the Persian Gulf. That is according to testimonies made by Arab officials themselves. Israel, for instance, had a direct role in the war waged against Yemen, and this is what the U.S. media documented. What was the result of this adventure? A total failure. So any preparation for a direct confrontation is not a base of concern for Iran. We hear and see every day in the news the preparations which the Axis of Resistance is undertaking and the high level of coordination that is now being spoken about overtly in the media, specifically in the latest rounds of Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip. So if it's about a possible confrontation, the Axis of Resistance is already very well prepared for any confrontation. As for the Israeli role, no one knows how Israel operates better than the Axis of Resistance. I don't think that the Axis of Resistance is concerned at the moment. It is for sure not as what the Saudi media is reporting about inverting balances of power in the region. This is only empty buzzwords by the pro-Israel media.
But maybe let's, for the sake of strategy, let us just suppose that there will be some sort of a scenario, or a scenario might be possible that can maybe bring about an armed conflict because of the launching of a Mesa against the Axis of Resistance in the area of West Asia. In the event of this scenario, how would West Asia look like after the dust settles, maybe?
Let us be frank here. We are talking about a region where the United States of America is seeking to relieve tension. simply because the current U.S. administration is dealing with urgent priorities, which imposes some sort of calm in West Asia. How is that translated on the ground in the region? At the moment, there is a dialogue going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran after it had been interrupted in the last year. Also, there is an ongoing dialogue taking place between Jordan and Iran for the past year. We also are following the preparations for a dialogue to take place between Iran and Egypt. All these talks are under the patronage of the Iraqi Republic. Would these dialogues have taken place had there not been a U.S. green light to allow it? This means that the U.S. has a desire to keep calm in the region. We heard recently about how the U.S. pressured Israel not to allow the March of Flags to take place in Al-Quds, despite the fact that Israel did not listen. Meanwhile, the U.S. negotiations with Iran are still on track, and it's being reported that the talks will continue as we approach the Biden visit to West Asia. These talks are currently a necessity given the ongoing Russian-Ukrainian war. The repercussions of this war have been very hard on Europe and the U.S. The economic crisis in the United States is deepening. The Biden administration is seeking to achieve any economic victory that would help it out in the upcoming U.S. primary elections. All this hints that the U.S. administration is seeking to reassure their public who are feeling the hard hits of the Russian-Ukrainian war. Hence, the U.S. seeks calm for now.
Well, it remains to be seen when the visit of Joe Biden approaches to the region of West Asia. It remains to be seen how this visit will be played out by the U.S. administration. I want to thank you very much from London, Ms. Isra Al-Fas, political commentator and journalist, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what Hezbollah did to frighten the Israelis in the Mediterranean.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, perhaps it was not expected by some in the region that Hezbollah would send a small squadron of its reconnaissance drones over the disputed Karish field with Lebanon, before the Lebanese government received the final response from the Israeli enemy to its offer that it made to the American envoy Amos Hochstein. Yet the resistance operation came along carrying a message of support to the Lebanese state with the aim of reminding it of the deterrence power that this state has benefited from in its equal negotiating position, and a message to the Israeli enemy that Lebanon is not weak and that it possesses all the components that make it insist on obtaining its rights and protect its sovereignty. Hezbollah drones over the Mediterranean in this following report.
The Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, announced on Saturday, July 2, that it had launched three unarmed drones in the direction of the disputed area at the Karish field on reconnaissance missions, stressing that the drones accomplished the required mission and delivered the message. The Islamic resistance said in a statement that the group of martyrs Jamil Skaf and Mahdi Yari launched three unarmed drones, adding that the drones were of various sizes and were launched in the direction of the disputed area at the Karish field. For its part, Israeli media reported that the Israeli occupation forces interrupted three Hezbollah drones, which were heading towards the Karish gas platform. Hezbollah had confirmed its readiness to take measures, including force, against Israeli gas drilling operations in the disputed offshore areas. Commenting on this, Israeli media announced that Hezbollah's launch of unarmed drones towards Karish is a hint that it does not want a military confrontation now, but this is an indication that it is capable of otherwise, and it may be repeated in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, the Israeli Channel 13 pointed out that when Hezbollah decides so, it will launch armed drones or missiles towards the gas platforms. It is noteworthy that the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, confirmed on June 9 that Lebanon is facing a new stage with the installation of a platform in the Karish gas field within a period of 3 months by the British-Greek company, which constitutes an attack on Lebanon. Sayed Nasrallah clarified that all the measures of the Israeli enemy cannot protect the floating platform nor the process of extracting gas from the Karish field, stressing that any folly that the enemy commits will have repercussions, not only strategic, but existential. Patriotic Lebanese stood behind the resistance in this new operation, simply because they knew that had it not been for the resistance, its position and capabilities, Lebanon would not have reached such a fortified and rigid position of peer-to-peer to negotiate with a strong enemy supported by the United States in this indirect negotiation on the demarcation of the maritime borders. The resistance has always chosen the timing and the action it took, especially in confronting the Israeli enemy, to be appropriate and productive in form and content for the actual interests of Lebanon and the interest of its sovereignty. It is only natural that the Lebanese today trust their resistance in sending these reconnaissance drones over the offshore Karish gas field, as it chose the appropriate timing and method for Lebanon's interest.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Birro, legal expert in international law and specifically maritime border law and the issue of gas and oil in Lebanon. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Birro. Now, some pro-U.S. voices in Lebanon claim that the resistance rushed these unarmed drones, this operation that they did on Saturday, and did not give the Lebanese government sufficient time for the initiative that the Americans were mediating with the Lebanese government so that the Zionist government might need some time to respond to the offer made by the Lebanese government. And thus, this constituted some kind of a pressure on Lebanese officials by the resistance in Lebanon. How do you approach such a claim?
We should first focus on the legal aspect of the disputed area. Legally, there's a disputed area in the Mediterranean between the Zionist entity and Lebanon. This area has great potential to be holding massive amounts of natural oil that was distilled from some companies. Since it has such riches, all parties involved should legally hold all investments in this disputed area until the dispute is resolved. What happened is an attempt at restoring things to the way they should be at this stage, meaning no drilling activities should be taking place as has been warned by the resistance Hezbollah, because obviously the Zionist entity was not taking the Lebanese warning seriously, in a way that the Stella drilling fleet took over the extraction site and attempted to further deepen the gas well. Stena also set a schedule to drill even more wells, making way for the FPSO ship, which will start the extraction. This resistance operation resettled the situation to the way it legally should be, waiting for the outcome of the ongoing negotiations.
Mr. Birro, when Lebanon recently presented its official offer indirectly to the Israeli enemy through the American representative, it refrained from mentioning the demarcation of the maritime borders with occupied Palestine or its position specifically on lines 29 and line 23, referring only to the idea of the enemy benefiting from extracting gas from Karish in return that Lebanon would benefit from extracting gas from Qana, which is way inside the Lebanese maritime border. I don't know why would they give that, despite the fact that it's inside their own maritime border to begin with. Do you think that this resistance operation is maybe a political statement by the Islamic resistance of Hezbollah for both the enemy and the Lebanese government by saying that Hezbollah believes that Line 29 should remain a Lebanese line?
I don't think so, because there were clear statements by the resistance that it stands firm behind the Lebanese government. Given that the government is responsible for demarcating its maritime borders, what happened was simply fixation of legal rules, as long as the U.S.-mediated negotiations are underway. and a change in the reality on the ground in terms of enabling the entity to extract gas, or the mere presence of the energene gas extraction vessel will escalate matters further. It would lead to Lebanon losing its rights. So this operation was a necessity. In the event, the Lebanese cabinet adopts Line 29 as being the official Lebanese border with occupied Palestine.
So you think that in the upcoming position that might be taken by the Zionist entity, that they might accept the offer after this operation, or might this operation actually hinder the acceptance of the Lebanese offer?
This operation comes in the form of an additional strong card in the hands of Lebanon. This hints that Lebanon has the upper hand in these negotiations, and that Lebanon is serious about protecting its rights, and that Lebanon possesses the necessary power to reclaim its rights, or at least to prevent Israel from investing in Lebanese gas in the maritime disputed area. I believe that this resistance operation should be invested properly, and rightfully so, by the Lebanese negotiating team, because it only empowers its negotiating position.
Well, Mr. Barrow, Hezbollah's message to the enemy came in the form of a clear warning. Firstly, about the seriousness of the resistance in Lebanon in approaching and following up this file in specific, and secondly, about the resistance capabilities, which Israel obviously knows very well. But by launching three non-offensive drones to be a gradual process, maybe moving forward towards a military operation later on, or a military intervention at increasing levels in the Mediterranean. What does international law hint towards such a military confrontation in the event it actually takes place, with a maritime dispute being its main basis to begin with?
According to the Lebanese ministerial statement, the resistance is part of the country's defense system, and what the resistance did reflects a Lebanese will to set things right and put them back in place. Therefore, international law protects the rights of the countries in defending their legitimate interests and natural resources. So this is the natural context for any country that exercises its right to self-defense or to hinder any threat that might touch its natural resources. As you know, these natural resources can be within both in the Lebanese territorial waters, which are an integral part of the Lebanese sovereignty, and also a part of the exclusive economic zone, in a way that Lebanon has sovereign rights related to the extraction of its natural resources.
But before I let you go, Mr. Ali, one last question in 30 seconds, maybe. In the event of a clash actually happens because of this point in particular, do you think that the American stance would still be a mediating one between Lebanon and the Zionist entity?
Since the beginning of the U.S. mediation and these ongoing negotiations, all the U.S. offers were actually in favor of the Israeli entity. The Lebanese negotiating team has not felt any neutrality from the U.S. side, neither then or now. Hence, whatever may happen, it will not change the general context of the U.S. trend in these negotiations.
Which brings us to a very important point as to why is an American actually mediating this issue when he obviously is taking sides here. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Barrow, legal expert in international law and maritime border dispute and the extraction of gas and oil from the international waters of Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us and for contribution. Thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime's so-called judicial system has not held the regime's military accountable for atrocities committed. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ola Musa activist. This article is published under the heading Gaza Father Stonewalled in Search for Justice. Stay tuned for more. The experience of Muhammad al-Hadidi illustrates how there is no way for Gaza's people to obtain justice. Muhammad's wife and all but one of his children were killed during a major Israeli regime attack last year. After the massacre, Muhammad examined the possibility of filing a lawsuit against the Zionist regime. He soon came to the conclusion that any such lawsuit would be futile. Lawyers informed him that if he wished to sue the Zionist regime, he would have to petition that regime's high court. "I do not trust Israeli courts," he said, adding, "They will not hold to account Israelis who believe in killing Palestinians. It is irrational to expect that they would." Muhammad also asked lawmakers and human rights groups if the International Criminal Court could investigate the crime that the Zionist regime committed against his family. For that to happen, Muhammad was told he would need support from the Palestinian Authority, a party to the ICC's founding charter, the Rome Statute. While some PA representatives promised to help Muhammad approach the ICC, he complained that the representatives have not kept their promises. He said, "I found that the road was full of obstacles. The stonewalling he has encountered makes it all more difficult for Muhammad to cope with the loss of so many family members." On May 15th last year, Muhammad's wife Maha and her five children were staying overnight with the family of Maha's brother Ala Abu Hatab in Gaza City's Beach refugee camp. Without issuing any warning, the Zionist regime fired a number of missiles at the family's home. Ala's wife Yasmin and four of their children were killed as a result, along with Maha and four of her children. The sole survivor in Muhammad's family was his son Omar, then a five-month-old baby. Omar was found lying on his mother's body. "The human mind cannot comprehend how a massacre like this can happen," said Muhammad. As soon as he heard about the incident, Muhammad rushed to Ala Abu Hatab's home. "The rubble from the building was still hot," he said, "and there was black smoke coming out of it. I saw the ambulance and civil defense crews, and just as I arrived, the body of my son, Sohaib, was found in pieces." Muhammad was left in no doubt that his family had almost entirely been wiped out. A tiny bit of solace was provided when he went to Al-Shafa Hospital and heard that Omar was still alive. 1 year on, Muhammad spends a great deal of time inside his small home in Beach refugee camp. Holding Omar, he walks up and down, constantly looking at the photographs of his dead children, including Sohaib, Yahya, Abdurrahman, and Osama. Muhammad has made few alterations to his home since the horrors of May 15, 2021 attack. The Israeli regime attack occurred during Eid al-Fitr. Muhammad has still not taken down the decorations for Ramadan, the month of fasting which precedes Eid last year. He recalled how his children were excited by Eid al-Fitr last year. He said they were so happy that they were going to their uncle's house. Another Ramadan and another Eid al-Fitr have passed since then. Muhammad avoided the celebrations this year as he found them too painful. He did not hold even one iftar, the meal which ends each day of fasting during Ramadan. In total, more than 250 Palestinians were killed, including at least 67 children during the May 2021 attack. It was the fourth major Israeli regime offensive against Gaza since December 2008. The Zionist regime's so-called judicial system has not held the regime's military accountable for atrocities committed in that period. One of the most widely reported incidents during a large-scale Israeli regime attack on Gaza in 2014 involved the killing of four children from the Bakr family who were playing football on a beach. After a military investigation into that massacre was closed, the Bakr family petitioned the Zionist regime's high court. Not only did the court refuse to order that the probe be reopened, it tried to justify the killings by accepting Israeli regime military claims that the children were so close to a shipping container, which Palestinian resistance groups use for storing weapons. Last year, the International Criminal Court approved the opening of an investigation into the situation in Palestine. Karim Khan, the ICC's chief prosecutor, has mainly been silent about the Palestine dossier. While the ICC has dragged its heels on holding the fake regime of Israel accountable, the flagrant double standards on display here will surely exacerbate the suffering of Gaza's bereaved parents.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Neither of us are a clean slate when it comes to human rights. Who is? But while Iran had a human rights cylinder as the foundation of its empire 2,500 years ago, America in the 21st century saw its police kill off a young black man, George Floyd, in cold blood.
I can breathe. Please, in the name of the...
What's worse is that peaceful protests that followed quickly became widespread chaos, with police cars driving into protesters and assaults on reporters. This is while the United States of America fancies itself as the world's biggest democracy. It supposedly is, which is why human rights abuse there has overspill.
That's because when its practice is so different from what it preaches, no one will follow America as it advocates human rights. Now that's an indirect effect. Iran has been directly targeted by American human rights abuse, beginning with sanctions. And it's the most vulnerable in our society that are hit hardest. I'm Leila Farah-Marzi. What's funny is in 2009, the then U.S. President Obama ordered sanctions against eight senior Iranian officials for alleged human rights abuses.
Sanctions were nothing new to Iran, but for the first time, they were on account of human rights by the U.S.
With the situation of human rights in the United States, Washington is not in a position to advise anyone. If you want to have a concern about human rights in the world, the first place to be focused is the United States. If one takes a look at the number of prisoners in the United States and then compares it to the population of this country, they would understand that the United States is the top country in the world in terms of having prisoners. The United States is recognized as a top country in terms of violating the rights of racial minorities.
Big Brother can be a good thing, but America has acted as the big bully on the block, rather. The many dimensions of U.S. human rights abuses against Iran pan over 40 years since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Abuses from triggering the war between Iran and Ba'athist Iraq of the 1980s to imposing brutal sanctions against Iran and Iranians. And from overt and covert interference in our internal affairs to killing innocents, even children. I'm not talking about the American people, although state-sculpted Iranophobia has shaped some American minds, be they private citizens or businesses.
They have demonized the Iranians in a way that when someone blocks Iranians' access to much-needed goods, they think that they've done the right thing. Iranophobia and Islamophobia have now been institutionalized in a way that, for example, if a hemophilia patient is denied access to much-needed medicine, some people say, okay, no problem. If it will lead to the death of an Iranian, then it's a good thing, because a terrorist is going to be removed from the earth. They have created a situation that those who block access to Iranians think that they're serving humanity, while this is not the case. Creating this big change is in a way that people think it's one of the capabilities of the mainstream media which is dominating the world. They have arguably succeeded in changing the way many people think.
Killing innocents, I said. Well, that can be by secondary sanctions on non-American companies exporting medicine to Iran or by downing a passenger plane. That's right, it was in 1988, just before the Iraq-Iran war ended, that USS Vincennes shot down Iran Air Flight 655. That was an SM-2MR surface-to-air missile. And it was no accident, going by evidence. Flight 655 was a scheduled passenger flight from Tehran to Dubai via Bandar Abbas. U.S. officials claimed the flight was not within its normal route, but a U.S. Navy report on July 28, 1988, refuted these claims. And as the plane was targeted, it hit the Persian Gulf waters, killing all 290 aboard.
The United States has waged the most wars after the Second World War. These wars have left many people died or wounded. Despite this fact, the United States still tries to play the role of an ethics instructor for the world. Washington tries to give the world advice on human rights. But if we take a look at the most important human rights violation cases like the Guantanamo prison in Cuba, or the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, or the massacre of the people of Vietnam, you will understand that the first human rights violation culprit is no one but the United States.
Indirect hostility is no better, only it takes longer to kill. By May 2021, nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, died since Molnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. For EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%, according to the Hague-based Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, ICICL. Molnlycke had decided in 2019 not to conduct any business in relation to Iran for the time being, due to U.S. sanctions.
The U.S. claims that food and medications are not subject to sanctions. As the father of an EB patient, as well as 750 other EB patients, I can tell you that it is not so in practice. I am feeling the sanctions. I am feeling the sanctions, for example, in dressing here for EB patients. From May 2017 to May 2018, 15 of our patients died due to the non-availability of dressing.
The patients are denied timely access to medicine because the financial flow and bank connections are blocked. Companies cannot pay for the medicine because of sanctions, or the government is not able to provide foreign exchange to import medicine or the raw material for the medicine because some of those drugs are produced inside our country, but their raw material is needed to be imported.
U.S. sanctions were not reason enough to acquit the Swedish company, looking at ICICL's having filed a complaint against it. That was on grounds Mölnlycke had failed to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, therefore adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impacts. The complaint read, "Disengagement decisions require mitigating likely impacts, and if companies are required to disengage, it should be done in a responsible manner."
I urgently refer you to the interview of Alina Dohan, the UN rapporteur, regarding unilateral sanctions on Iran. She has made it clear that many Iranian patients have been denied full medication and have suffered from lack of medicine, bank limitations, and other problems resulted by unilateral sanctions on Iran.
We send the plasma of some medicines to Germany. They change it into concentrates and return it to Iran. Here we take blood plasma from human and send it to Germany for them to produce medicine out of them. Now the sanctions have made it very difficult to push this process forward, and the result is that the medicine arrives in Iran so late that they are only a few months away from being expired.
EB is just one of special and rare diseases impacted by sanctions. Hemophilia is another, and we've got the Hemophilia Association chief on board. Of 13,000 registered hemophiliacs in the country, all need government-sponsored imported medicine, because otherwise it's going to be a painfully regressive existence for them. Even to produce domestic medicine, raw materials will soon have to be imported again, he says, as we've only enough to cover two more months. But
thing is, everything is interconnected. We see our tradesmen are boycotted. They can't even perform their trade with third parties, with non-American companies. This must be affecting even medicine getting into the country, raw materials for medicine. Do comment.
Recently, I was speaking to the representatives of one of these companies. They said they had problems importing raw material. They said no need to import raw material for medicine. They sign a contract with a company, and then that company signs another contract with a third company to import the raw materials. The next time they go for more raw material, they find out that the third company has been blacklisted. Then they are forced to find another company to take raw material from. They have to create a new cycle to have access to raw material again.
John Perkins has a book topped The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In this book, he says that he entered countries as a World Bank staff worker, but he was actually a CIA agent. He told those countries that as a staff worker, he has coordinated with the World Bank for them to be paid in loans and financial assistance, but they must sign contracts only with companies that the World Bank confirms as qualified parties. On the other hand, all the companies confirmed by the World Bank were American companies, and if they failed to repay their debts, he would tell them, okay, no problem. If you want to be forgiven, your votes in UN bodies should be in favor of the United States.
Now, shall we call it U.S. for democracy or U.S. the face of hypocrisy? There has been immeasurable collateral damage from what is actually sanctions to curb Iran's regional influence while attempting what the U.S. terms regime change here by social uprisings. time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
For more on hypocritical democracy, do stay tuned. But for now, a quick diversion into global media to see what other outlets have said. Here's how it looks on the page. The Guardian has a piece on the situation in Yemen, a reminder Yemen and human rights don't mix. They haven't for the past few years with all the foreign interference. U.S. has not fully investigated own role in Yemen rights abuses, watchdog finds. The U.S. government has not fully investigated its own role in perpetuating human rights abuses in Yemen, according to a congressional watchdog report that offered a damning assessment of both the Trump and Biden administration's commitment to tracking violations of humanitarian law. A report by the Government Accountability Office, which examined U.S. weapon sales to the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, also raised serious doubts about one of Joe Biden's first foreign policies as president when he announced that his administration was ending U.S. support for Saudi offensive operations in Yemen. The report's examination of nearly $60 billion in U.S. weapon sales to the Saudi-led coalition from a period spanning 2015 to 2021 is the second time a watchdog has attempted to investigate the U.S.'s own culpability in contributing to violation of humanitarian laws in the Yemen conflict. In August 2020, a State Department inspector general found that the department was failing to take measures to reduce civilian deaths. The Global Times reads, China calls on UN to address human rights violations against indigenous women and girls in U.S., Canada, Australia. The Chinese representative called on the UN human rights mechanisms to continue to pay attention to such violations. The representative made the remarks during a speech at a dialogue with the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women at the 50th session of the UN Human Rights Council. China is deeply concerned about the issues reported at the meeting by the Special Rapporteur, including the violence against politically active indigenous women in the U.S., obstacles for indigenous women and girls to seek justice in the U.S., and genocide crimes by Canada against indigenous people, the representative said. In these countries, indigenous women and girls face oppression and discrimination and are at serious risk of violence, according to the representative. Seeing as America and its high horse are pretty much in the spotlight these days, Tasnim News quotes Gharib Abadi saying, U.S. in no position to comment on human rights, Gharib Abadi being Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights. The official made the remarks on the sidelines of the Fourth International Conference on the American Human Rights from the perspective of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. This government, meaning the U.S. administration, should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation, Gharib Abadi added. He cited the example of the people of Yemen, where Saudi Arabia and its allies have been waging a U.S.-backed war, Press TV reported. The Yemenis were still being deprived of receiving the most basic humanitarian assistance due to the invaders and their supporters' imperialist disposition and great human rights violations, the official noted. The United States returned its sanctions against Iran in 2018 after leaving a historic accord between Iran and others. That'll be it for the news section today. Having referred to missiles and war before the break, by mid-October 2020, a long-standing conventional arms embargo imposed on Iran expired in line with the terms of the nuclear deal as part of Resolution 2231 of the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That's the accord signed in 2015 between Iran and world powers to give this country sanctions relief
in return for curbs on its nuclear program. However, after years of UN and then US sanctions, Iran had learned to be self-reliant for its defense. Iran is now producing from unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs,